Get your hair done, by the way, Jamie said. It's a very flattering cut.
Heliotrope in town, I said. Laura did it. She's a friend of mine, I said proudly.
Jamie looked impressed.
I might try them out, she said. My hairdresser is moving up north, so I'm looking for someone new. Does your friend do wedding hair, do you know?
I rummaged in my shopper.
Here's a card, I said. Why not give her a call?
Janie beamed at me. Could this be right? I smiled back quickly, if in doubt smile, remember, and made for my desk.
Was this how it worked then? Successful social integration? Was it really that simple? Wear some lipstick, go to the hairdressers and alternate the clothes you wear? Someone ought to write a book, or at least an explanatory pamphlet, and pass this information on. I'd had more attention from them today, non-malevolent positive attention, that is, than I'd had in the last few years. I smiled to myself, pleased that I'd unlocked part of the puzzle. An electronic message arrived.
You ran off on Saturday without saying cheerio. Everything okay? R.
I hit reply. Fine, thank you. I had simply had enough of the dancing and other people. E.
He replied instantly.
Lunch, usual place, 12:30. R.
Much to my surprise, I realised that I actually liked the idea of having lunch with Raymond and was genuinely pleased to be asked. We had a usual place. I steeled myself as best I could, and with teeth gritted, using only one finger, I typed, "See you there." E. I sat back, feeling a bit queasy. Illiterate communication was quicker, that was true, but not by much. I'd saved myself the trouble of typing four whole characters. Still, it was part of my new credo, trying new things. I tried it, and I very definitely did not like it. L-O-L could go and take a running jump. I wasn't made for illiteracy. It simply didn't come naturally. Although it's good to try new things and to keep an open mind, it's also extremely important to stay true to who you really are. I read that in a magazine at the hairdresser's. Raymond was already there when I arrived, chatting to a different yet almost identical young man with a beard from the one who'd served us last time. I ordered a frothy coffee and a cheese scone again, which made Raymond smile.
You're a creature of habit, Eleanor, aren't you?
I shrugged.
You look nice, by the way, he said. I like your...
He gestured indistinctly at my face. I nodded. People seem to like me better with makeup on, for some reason, I said. He raised his eyebrows and shrugged, apparently as stumped as I was. The bearded man brought our food and Raymond began shoveling it into his face.
Did you have a good time on Saturday then? He asked.
I wished it had been between mouthfuls, but it was, in fact, horrifically, during one. Yes, thank you, I said. It was the first time I've tried dancing and I quite enjoyed it. He kept forking the food into his mouth. The process and the noise seemed almost industrial in its relentlessness. Did you enjoy yourself? I asked.
Mm-hmm, he said. It was fun, wasn't it?
He wasn't using a knife, but held a fork in his right hand like a child or an American. He smiled. I considered asking whether he and Laura had danced again that evening, whether he'd escorted her home, but decided against it. It was none of my business, after all, and intrusive questions are very ill-mannered.
So, did you decide about the promotion? Are you going to take it?
I had, of course, been pondering this in spare moments throughout the preceding days. I had looked for signs, clues. None were forthcoming, however, except that last Friday, 12 across, had read, "In favour of upwards movement, 9. I had taken this as an encouraging omen. "I'm going to say yes," I said. He smiled, put down his fork and held up his hand. I realised I was meant to place mine against his in what I now recognised as a high five.
"Nice one," he said, resuming his lunch. "Congratulations."
I felt a flash of happiness, like a match being struck. I couldn't recall ever having been congratulated on anything before. It was very pleasant indeed. "How's your mother, Raymond?" I asked him, having enjoyed the moment and the last of the scone.
He talked about her for a while, told me she'd been asking after me. I felt slightly concerned about this, a default anxiety pertaining to maternal inquisitiveness, but he put my mind at rest.
"She really liked you. Said to tell you to pop over any time," he said. "She's lonely."
I nodded. I had recognised that. He excused himself and plodded off to the bathroom, and I gazed around the cafe while I awaited his return. Two women around my age were seated at the table next to me, each with a brightly dressed baby. Both infants were in car seats. One was asleep, the other stared dreamily at a beam of sunlight as it danced on the wall. The coffee machine hissed into life behind us, and I watched alarm ripple in waves across his face. In slow motion, his sweet pink mouth puckered into a kiss and then opened wide to release a wail at quite momentous volume. His mother glanced down and, reassured that he was fine despite the noise, continued her conversation. The crying got louder. It made evolutionary sense, I supposed, that a baby's cries of distress would be tuned to precisely the right pitch and volume to make them impossible for an adult human to ignore. He was winding himself up now, fists balled furiously, his face getting redder by the minute. I closed my eyes, tried and failed to ignore the noise. "Please stop crying, please stop crying. I don't know why you are crying. What do I need to do to make you stop? I don't know what to do. Are you hurt? Are you ill? Hungry? I don't know what to do. Please don't cry. There isn't anything to eat. Mummy will be back soon. Where's Mummy?" My hand was shaking as I picked up my coffee cup, and I breathed as slowly as I could, staring at the tabletop. The crying ceased. I looked up and saw the baby lying quietly in his mother's arms now as she covered his face with kisses. I breathed out. My heart soared for him. When Raymond returned, I paid for lunch since he had paid last time. I was really starting to get the hang of the concept of a payment schedule. He insisted on leaving the tip, however. £5. All the man had done was carry our food from the kitchen to the table, a job for which he was already being recompensed by the cafe owner. Raymond was reckless and profligate. No wonder he couldn't afford proper shoes or an iron. We walked back slowly to the office, and Raymond told me in detail about some computer server issue that I did not understand and didn't particularly care to, that he would have to deal with that afternoon. In the lobby, he turned towards the stairs where his office was located.
"See you soon, yeah?"
he said.
"Take care."
He actually sounded like he meant both, that he would indeed see me soon and that he wished me to take care of myself. I felt a warmth inside, a cosy, glowy feeling like hot tea on a cold morning. "Take care yourself, Raymond," I said, and I meant it. That evening, I had planned to relax with a cup of Bovril and listen to a very interesting radio program about South American politics, after completing my usual checks on what Johnny Lomond was up to. He'd sent a desultory tweet about a character in a television program and posted a photograph on Facebook of a new pair of boots he wanted. A slow news day, then. Hearing from Mummy on a Monday was an unexpected, unwelcome surprise.
"Eleanor, darling, not our usual time to talk, I know, but I was thinking about you. Just wanted to say hello, see how you were getting on, you know, the sort of thing."
I was silent, shocked by the unscheduled intrusion into my evening.
"Well," she said, "I'm waiting, darling."
I cleared my throat.
I'm fine, Mummy. You were thinking about me?"
This was a first.
Two things, really. First of all, do you want me to see if I can give you a hand with your project? I can't do much from where I am, obviously, but I might be able to, I don't know, pull some strings. Might there perhaps be some way I could engineer a little visit, come and help you? I mean, I know it sounds impossible, but one never knows. Mountains can always be moved and so on.
"No, Mummy. Oh, no, no, no," I said, gabbling. I heard her breathe in and forced my words into order. What I mean, Mummy, I heard the hiss as she released the air trapped in her lungs, is that it's very kind of you to offer, but I think I'm going to decline.
Might one ask why? She said, sounding somewhat put out.
It's just, I really do think I've got everything under control here, I said. I think it'd be better if you stayed put, as it were. I'm not sure there's anything more you can do at this point.
Well, darling, if you're sure. But I'm very efficient, you know. And to be frank, you're a bit of a bumbling idiot at times.
I sighed as quietly as I could. And furthermore, she went on, I'm getting rather impatient now. Things need to move forward with this man, you know. A bit more action, Eleanor. That's what's needed, darling. She was starting to sound calmer now.
Yes, Mummy, yes, you're absolutely right, of course.
It was true that since the time when I'd first seen the musician, my interest, and therefore my progress, had been subsumed by more pressing matters over the last few weeks. There were so many other things to be getting on with. Raymond, the new job, Sammy and his family. But she was right.
I'll try to move things along a bit faster, I said.
That had placated her, I hoped, and she started to say her goodbyes.
Oh, wait, Mummy. Hang on a second. You said there were two things? What was the second thing you were thinking about?
Oh, yes, she said, and I heard her dismissive sideways hiss of cigarette smoke.
It was just that I wanted to tell you that you're a pointless waste of human tissue, that was all. Bye then, darling, she said,
bright as a knife. Silence.
At Johnny Elrock's. Newsflash. I'm leaving Pilgrim Pioneers. No hard feelings. Totally respect those guys. Hashtag solo artist. Hashtag a star is born. One of two. At Johnny Elrock's. I'm going solo in a different, stronger musical direction. More soon. Peace out. Hashtag iconoclast. Two of two.
Chapter 22. Mummy got in touch again on Wednesday as usual, the interval between our conversations all too brief.
What ho, she said. Me again. Anything new to share with Mummy?
In the absence of any other salient news since Monday, I told her about Keith's birthday party.
Quite the social butterfly these days, aren't you, Eleanor? She said, her voice unpleasantly sweet.
I said nothing. It's usually the safest course of action.
What did you wear? I bet you looked ridiculous. For the love of God, please tell me you didn't attempt to dance, daughter mine.
She somehow intuited the answer from my tense silence.
Oh, dear, she said. Dancing's for the beautiful people, Eleanor. The thought of you lumbering about like a walrus.
She laughed long and hard.
Thank you. Thanks very much, darling. That's made my night. It really has.
She laughed again.
Eleanor, dancing.
How are you, Mummy? I said quietly. Fine, darling, just fine. It's chilly night tonight, always a treat. We're going to watch a film later. The Wonder of Wednesdays.
Her tone was breezy, cheerful. It had a borderline manic quality that I recognised.
I got promoted, Mummy, I said, unable to keep a little flash of pride from my voice.
She snorted.
Promoted? How incredibly impressive, darling. What does that mean? An extra £5 a month?
I said nothing.
Still, she said, her voice dripping with patronising sweetness. Good for you, darling. I mean it, really. Well done.
I looked at the floor, felt tears come. She spoke to someone else, a semi-snarl.
No, I fucking didn't. I said Sex in the City too. Aye, I did. I thought we were taking a vote.
Eh? Again?
Oh, for fucks.
She spoke directly to me again.
My fellow residents have elected to watch The Shawshank Redemption yet again, if you can believe it. It's only been, 20 consecutive Wednesdays now.
Listen, don't go getting sidetracked from your project with all this new job and birthday party nonsense. There's a task in hand and you need to remain focused on it. Faint heart never won fair chap, you know. Imagine if you were to provide me with a handsome, appropriate son-in-law, Eleanor. That would be normal, darling, wouldn't it? Would be a normal family then. She laughed, and I did too. The concept was just too bizarre to contemplate. I was cursed with daughters, she said sadly. And yet I always wanted a son. A son-in-law will do at a push, so long as he's suitable. You know, polite, thoughtful, considerate, well-behaved. He is all of those things, isn't he, this project of yours, Eleanor? A well-dressed man, well-spoken? You know I've always tried to impress upon you how appropriate it is to talk properly and look the part. He seems very nice, Mummy, I said. Very suitable. Handsome and talented and successful. Glamorous, I said, warming to my theme. Obviously I knew next to nothing about him, so I was embellishing the scant information I'd gleaned about Johnny Lohman from my research. It was quite fun. Her tone was dismissive with an undercurrent of menace, the default tone. Oh, God, I'm bored now. I'm bored of this conversation and I'm bored of waiting for you to complete this project. Off you trot, Eleanor. For heaven's sake, please don't trouble yourself by being proactive and pushing forward with it. Oh, no. Heaven forfend. Please continue to do nothing. Go and sit in your empty little flat and watch television on your own just like you do every single night. I heard her shout, I'm coming. Don't you start without me. The click of a lighter, an intake of breath. Mustache, Eleanor. Toodaloo. Dead air. I sat down and watched television alone, like I do every single night. I suppose one of the reasons we're all able to continue to exist for our allotted span in this green and blue veil of tears is that there is always, however remote it might seem, the possibility of change. I never thought in my strangest imaginings that I would find my job anything other than 8 hours of drudgery. It was a source of astonishment to me that, on many days of the week now, I'd check my watch and see that hours had gone by without my noticing. The office manager role involved numerous new tasks that I had to learn and perfect. None of them was beyond the wit of man, obviously, but some were reasonably complex, and I was surprised at how enthusiastically my brain responded to the new challenges placed before it. My colleagues had appeared somewhat underwhelmed upon hearing the news that I would be managing them, but thus far at least there had been no sign of mutiny or insubordination. I kept myself to myself, as always, and allowed them to get on with their jobs, or what passed for doing their jobs, insofar as they never actually did very much, and tended to make a mess of the few tasks they actually attempted. For the time being at least, the status quo prevailed, and they were, so far, no more ineffectual than they'd been prior to my installation. The new role meant interacting with Bob more frequently, and I discovered that he was actually quite an amusing interlocutor. He shared a lot of details about the day-to-day running of the business with me, and was delightfully indiscreet about clients. Clients, I soon learned, could be very demanding. I still had limited direct contact with them, which suited me just fine. From what I could gather, they would routinely be completely unable to articulate their requirements, at which point, in desperation, the designers would create some artwork for them based on the few vague hints they had managed to elicit. After many hours of work involving a full team of staff, the work would be submitted to the client for approval. At that point, the client would say, "No, that's exactly what I don't want." There would be several tortuous iterations of this process before the client finally declared his or herself satisfied with the end results. Inevitably, Bob said, the artwork that was signed off at the end of the process was virtually identical to the first piece of work submitted, which the client had immediately dismissed as unsuitable. It was no wonder, I thought, that he kept the staff room well stocked with beer, wine and chocolate,
and that the art team availed themselves of it quite so frequently. I'd started planning the Christmas lunch, too. I'd only vague ideas at the moment, but like our clients, I was very clear as to what I didn't want. No chain restaurants or hotels. No turkey, no Santa. Nowhere that said corporate entertainment or office party on their website. It would take time to track down the perfect venue and plan the perfect event, but I had months yet. Raymond and I continued to meet for lunch roughly once per week. It was always on a different day, which annoyed me, but he was a man who was extremely resistant to routine, something that shouldn't have surprised me. One day he emailed me less than 24 hours after we'd met to invite me for lunch again the very next day. I could almost believe that someone might enjoy or at least tolerate my company over the duration of a brief luncheon, but it stretched credibility to think that it could happen twice in 1 week. "Dear R, I'd be delighted to meet you for lunch again, but I'm somewhat perplexed due to the proximity to our previous meeting. Is everything in order? Regards, E." He replied thus, "Got something I need to tell you. See you at 12:30, R." We were so habituated to our lunchtime meetings that he did not even need to specify the venue. When I arrived, he wasn't there, so I perused a newspaper that was lying on the chair next to me. Strangely, I'd come to like this shabby place. The staff, whilst off putting an appearance, were uniformly pleasant and friendly, and now more than one of them was able to say, "The usual, is it?" to me, and then bring my coffee and cheese scone without my having to request it. It's very vain and superficial of me, I know, but it made me feel like someone in an American situation comedy, being a regular, having a usual. The next step would have been effortlessly witty badinage, but unfortunately we were still some way away from that. One of the staff, Mikey, came over with a glass of water. "Do you want yours now, or are you waiting for Raymond?" he said. I told him I was expecting Raymond imminently, and Mikey began wiping down the table next to me. "How's tricks, anyway?" he asked. "I'm fine," I said. "It feels like we're getting towards the last days of summer." This was something I had been thinking as I walked to the cafe, feeling gentle rays on my face, seeing a few red and gold leaves amongst the green. Mikey nodded. "I'm finishing up here at the end of the month," he said. "Oh," I said, "that's a pity." Mikey was kind and gentle and always brought truffles with the coffees without being asked or seeking additional payment. "Have you found a new position somewhere else?" I said. "No," he said, perching on a chair beside me. "Hazel's really poorly again." Hazel, I knew, was his girlfriend, and they lived nearby with their Bichon Frise and their baby, Lois. "I'm very sorry to hear that, Mikey," I said. He nodded. "They thought they got rid of it all the last time, but it's come back, spread to the lymph nodes and the liver. I just wanted to, you know." "You wanted to spend the time she has left with Hazel and Lois, rather than serving cheese scones to strange women," I said. And gratifyingly, he laughed.
"That's about the size of it," he said.
I braced myself, then put my hand on his arm. I was going to say something, but then I couldn't think what was the right thing to say, so I just kept silent and looked at him, hoping he'd intuit what I meant, that I was desperately sorry, that I admired him for caring so much about Hazel and Lois and looking after them, that I understood, perhaps more than most, about loss, about how difficult things must be and would continue to be. However much you loved someone, it wasn't always enough. Love alone couldn't keep them safe. "Thanks, Eleanor," he said gently. He thanked me. Raymond arrived and threw himself into his seat.
"All right, mate," he asked Mikey. "How's Hazel doing?"
"Not bad, Raymond, not bad. I'll get you a menu."
After he'd left, I leaned forward. "You knew already about Hazel?" I said. He nodded.
"It's shite, isn't it? She's not even 30 and wee Lois is me too yet."
He shook his head. Neither of us spoke. There really wasn't anything else to say. Once we had ordered, Raymond cleared his throat.
I've got something to tell you, Eleanor. It's more bad news. Sorry.
I sat back in my chair and looked up at the ceiling, readying myself.
Go on, I said.
There's very little in life that I couldn't imagine or brace myself for. Nothing could be worse than what I've already experienced. That sounds like hyperbole, but it's a literal statement of fact. I suppose it's actually a source of strength in a strange way.
It's Sammy, he said.
I hadn't been expecting that.
He passed away at the weekend, Eleanor. A massive coronary.
It was quick, at least. I nodded. It was both a surprise and not a surprise. What happened? I said.
Raymond started eating, telling me the details between and during mouthfuls.
I'm not sure what it would take to put that man off his food. The Ebola virus, perhaps.
He was at Laura's, he said, just watching the telly. No warning, nothing.
Was she there at the time? I asked. Please God, let her have been spared that. Trying to live on afterwards, trying to manage the guilt and the pain and the horror of it all. I would not wish that on another human being. I would happily assume her burden if I could. I'd barely notice it, I'm sure, on top of my own.
She was upstairs getting ready to go out, he said. Got a hell of a shock when she came down and found him on the sofa like that.
So it wasn't her fault. She couldn't have saved him, even if she'd tried. It was fine. Well, as fine as death could be. I considered the facts further. He was alone at the time death occurred, then, I said, intrigued. Do the police suspect foul play? He choked on his halloumi burger, and I had to pass him a glass of water.
For fuck's sake, Eleanor, he said.
I'm sorry, I said. It was just something that popped into my mind.
Aye, well, sometimes best not to say the first thing that pops into your mind out loud, eh?
He said quietly, not looking at me. I felt terrible. I felt terrible for Sammy and for his family. I felt terrible for upsetting Raymond without meaning to. I felt terrible for the waiter and his girlfriend and their poor little baby. All this death, all this suffering happening to nice people, good people who'd done nothing to deserve it and no one able to stop it. Tears came. And the more I tried to fight them, the more they came. The lump in my throat was burning, burning like fire. No, please, not fire. Raymond had slid around to the seat beside me and put his arm around my shoulders. He spoke in a soft, low voice.
Oh, please, Eleanor, don't cry. I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to snap at you. I really didn't. Please, Eleanor.
The strange thing, something I'd never expected, was that it actually made you feel better when someone put their arm around you, held you close. Why? Was it some mammalian thing, this need for human contact? He was warm and solid. I could smell his deodorant and the detergent he used to wash his clothes. Over both scents there lay a faint patina of cigarettes. A Raymond smell. I leaned in closer. Eventually I managed to regain control of my emotions, and the embarrassing tears abated. I sniffed, and he returned to his own side of the table. Rummaged in his jacket pocket and passed me a packet of tissues. I smiled at him, took one, and blew my nose. I was aware that I was making a most unladylike honking sound, but what else could I do?
Sorry, I said.
He gave me a feeble smile.
I know, he said. It's really hard, isn't it?
I took a moment to process everything that he'd told me. How's Laura? What about Keith and Gary?
They're in bits, as you'd expect.
I'm going to attend the funeral, I said, decisively.
Me too,
he said. He slurped on his cola.
He was a funny old bloke, wasn't he?
I smiled, swallowed down the lump in my throat. He was nice, I said. You could tell that straight away, even when he was unconscious on the pavement. Raymond nodded. He reached across the table and squeezed my hand.
At least he had a few weeks with his family after the accident, eh? Good weeks, as we party, Keith's 40th.
He got a chance to spend time with all the people he loved. I nodded. Can I ask you something, Raymond? I said.
He looked at me. What's the etiquette for funerals? Are mourners still required to wear black and are hats de rigueur? He shrugged.
No idea. Just wear whatever you want, I guess. Sammy's not the kind of guy who'd be bothered about that sort of thing, is he?
I pondered this. I'll wear black, I said, to be on the safe side. No hat, though.
No, I'm not wearing a hat either, said Raymond,
and we actually laughed. We laughed far longer than his feeble witticism merited, just because it felt good. We didn't speak on the walk back to the office. The weak sun was in our faces, and I held mine up to it for a moment, like a cat. Raymond was scuffing through the light carpet of fallen leaves, his red training shoes flashing through all the bronze. A grey squirrel bounded in fluid semicircles across our path, and there was that almost autumnal smell in the air, apples and wool. We didn't even speak when we got inside. Raymond took both my hands in his and squeezed them just for a second, and then released them at my sides. He went upstairs and I walked around the corner to my office. I felt like a newly laid egg, all swishy and gloopy inside and so fragile that the slightest pressure could break me. There was already an email waiting for me by the time I sat down at my desk.
See you Friday, R. Kiss.
Was a response required? I suspected it was, so I just sent this. Kiss. Chapter 23. I was getting the hang of this shopping business. I had returned to the same department store and, after seeking advice from a different shop assistant, had purchased a black dress, black tights and black shoes. This was my first dress since childhood, and it felt strange to have my legs on public display. She had tried to steer me towards vertiginous heels again. Why are these people so incredibly keen on crippling their female customers? I began to wonder if cobblers and chiropractors had established some fiendish cartel. On reflection, though, she was correct in stating that the fitted black dress did not really go with either my new boots, too informal apparently, or my Velcro work shoes. It appeared that nothing did, much to my surprise. I had thought that they were the very definition of versatility. We compromised with some improbably named kitten heels, which, contrary to what one might think, had nothing to do with cats. They were heels which were easy to walk in, but which were nonetheless very feminine. On what basis was this decided, and by whom? Did it matter? I made a mental note to research gender politics and gender identity at some point. There would be a book about it. There were books about everything. On this trip, I'd even bought a handbag, judging that my shopper probably wouldn't be appropriate for a funeral. The fabric was imprinted with a very jaunty pattern, and I felt it might stand out at a graveside. The wheels could also be a bit squeaky. The bag I finally settled on was impractical, being far too small to carry, for example, either a hardback book or a bottle of Glen's. I examined it when I got home, stroking its glossy leather outer and silky fabric lining. It had a long gold chain which you simply placed over your shoulder, leaving your hands free. At further horrendous expense, I'd also bought a black wool coat, single-breasted, knee-length, fitted. It was warm and plain, characteristics that I found attractive. Looking at all my purchases spread across my bed for closer examination, I assuaged my concerns about the cost by reassuring myself that the entire outfit could be worn again and again, either together or separately. I now owned what I believed was called a capsule wardrobe, clothes which were appropriate for most social events that the musician and I might attend together. I'd look right in them, on his arm. An evening at the ballet, perhaps? The opening night of a new play? I knew he'd be opening up uncharted worlds for me. At least now I had the appropriate shoes for them. I'd spent more in these last few weeks than I usually spent in a year. Social interaction, it appeared, was surprisingly expensive. The travel, the clothes, the drinks, the lunches, the gifts. Sometimes it evened out in the end, like with the drinks.
but I was finding out, more often than not, one occurred a net financial loss. I'd a bit of money saved up, but it only amounted to a month's wages or so, and Bob's paychecks were far from generous. I saw now that this had only been possible because I hadn't had much requirement to spend money on the social aspects of life before now. Mummy liked to live extravagantly, but after everything changed, I'd learned that money was something to worry about, to ration. It had to be asked for and then counted out into my red, raw hands. I never forgot, and was never allowed to forget, that someone else was paying for my clothes, the food I ate, even for the heating in the room where I slept. My foster carers received an allowance for looking after me, and I was always conscious of making sure not to cause them to exceed it by needing things, and especially not by wanting things. Allowance is not a generous, lavish word. I earn my own money now, of course, but I have to be careful with it. Budgeting is a skill, and a very useful one at that. After all, if I were to run out of funds, find myself indebted, there is no one, not a single soul, on whom I could call to bail me out. I'd be destitute. I have no anonymous benefactor to pay my rent, no family members or friends who could kindly lend me the money to replace a broken vacuum cleaner or pay the gas bill until I could return the borrowed sum to them on payday. It was important that I did not allow myself to forget that. Nevertheless, I couldn't attend Sammy's funeral in inappropriate clothing. The black dress, the assistant assured me, was smart, but could also be dressed down. The coat could be worn all winter. My jerkin had more than paid for itself over the years, but I would keep it, of course, in case it was required again in future. I hung everything up carefully. I was ready. Bring out your dead. Friday was bright, although it was impossible to tell if it would stay that way. I showered and put on my new clothes. It had been many years since I'd worn tights, preferring a handy pair of pop socks under my slacks, but I still remembered how to roll them on. I was very careful, as they were thin and delicate and could be ripped in an instant by a careless fingernail. I felt enclosed in them somehow, as though I was wearing someone else's skin. I'd made my legs black and my hair blonde. I'd lengthened and darkened my eyelashes, dusted a flush of pink onto my cheeks and painted my lips a shade of dark red which was rarely found in nature. I should, by rights, look less like a human woman than I'd ever done, and yet it seemed that this was the most acceptable, the most appropriate appearance that I'd ever made before the world. It was puzzling. I suppose I could have gone further, made my skin glow with tanning agent, scented myself with a spray made from chemicals manufactured in a laboratory, distilled from plants and animal parts. I did not want to do that. I picked up my new bag and locked the door behind me. For safety and security reasons, I had specified that I should be collected from a location on a main road near my flat, rather than disclose my home address, and an unprepossessing vehicle drew up outside the building at the correct time. The driver glanced quickly in the rear-view mirror as I slid into the seat behind him, next to Raymond. It took a while, as I was conscious of my dress, trying to make sure that it did not reveal more of my legs than it was designed to. Everything took so long. Before, I'd simply bathed, run a comb through my hair, and pulled on my trousers. Being feminine apparently meant taking an eternity to do anything, and involved quite a bit of advanced planning. I couldn't imagine how it would be possible to hike to the source of the Nile, or to climb up a ladder to investigate a malfunction inside a particle accelerator, wearing kitten heels and 10 denier tights. It was hard to gauge the full effect of Raymond's outfit, but it was apparent, even from this position, that he was wearing an ironed white shirt, a black tie, and black trousers. I couldn't see his feet, and issued a silent prayer that he was not shod in training shoes, even black ones. "You look nice," he said. I nodded, feeling slightly self-conscious in my new dress, and looked at him again. He hadn't shaved off his odd little beard, but it had been trimmed and his hair was combed neatly. The taxi moved off and we joined the slow morning traffic. The radio jabbered nonsense, and we didn't look at one another or speak. There was really nothing to be said. The crematorium was in the suburbs, a 1970s monstrosity of white concrete and brutal angles. The gardens were neat in a sterile, municipal way, but surprisingly were full of beautiful blown roses. There were lots of mature trees around the perimeter, which pleased me. I liked to think of their roots, coursing with life, snaking under this place. We drew up in an enormous car park which was already almost full, although it was only 10:30. The place was out of the way and would be impossible to reach by public transport, which was completely illogical. There ought to be a train or a shuttle bus, I thought. It was a place we were all guaranteed to be visiting at some point. Raymond paid the driver and we stood for a moment, taking it in.
"Ready?" he said.
I nodded. There were lots of other mourners, moving through the grounds like slow black beetles. We walked up the path in silent agreement that we were in no hurry to leave the trees and the roses and the sunshine and go inside. A long hearse sat at the front door and we looked at the coffin, which was covered in wreaths. A coffin was a wooden box in which Sammy's corpse would be lying. What was he wearing in there, I wondered. I hoped it was that nice red jumper, cosy, smelling of him. We sat down on the left-hand side of the room, in a pew not too far from the front. The place was half full already, and there was a low hum of muttered conversation, a muted, insect-like buzzing that I hadn't heard in any other venue or set of circumstances. I picked up one of the sheets that had been placed along the pews. "Samuel McMurray Tom," it said, 1940 to 2017. Inside it told us what would happen, listed the readings and hymns, and suddenly I was overwhelmed with a desire for it to be over, not to have to be there and experience it all. Raymond and I were silent. The room was much nicer inside than the exterior had suggested, with wooden beams and a high vaulted ceiling. The entire side wall to the left of where we were seated was glass, and we could see the rolling lawns and more of those huge primeval trees in the background. I was glad. Nature should make her presence felt in the room in some way, I thought. Living nature, not cut flowers. The sun was quite bright now, and the trees cast short shadows, although autumn was creeping up through a shimmer of wind in the leaves. I turned around and saw that the room was full, perhaps 100 people, maybe more. The buzzing hum threatened to drown out the dull recorded organ music. Something shifted in the air and silence fell. Both of his sons and four other men, whose faces I recognized from the party, carried Sammy's coffin down the aisle and placed it gently on a sort of raised platform with a roller belt, at the end of which was a set of red velvet curtains. I tried to remember what the platform reminded me of, and it came to me. The supermarket checkout in Tesco, where you place your items and then move towards the cashier. I leaned across to tell Raymond, but he had fished a bag of peppermints from his suit pocket and offered me one before I could speak. I popped it in and sucked. Other people had joined us on the pew, and we'd had to shuffle up like crabs to make space for them. I was therefore in very close proximity to Mr. Raymond Gibbons. I noticed that he smelled extremely pleasant today. The peppermints, of course, but also a clean soap scent, something almost woody, like cedar. I hadn't seen him smoke a cigarette yet. I suppose even Raymond would think it inappropriate to smoke a cigarette outside a crematorium. The rest of the family entered and sat beside Sammy's boys on the front pew. Laura was on her own, looking impossibly glamorous. Dark glasses, indoors, astonishing. They were followed by a jolly-looking minister. A man at a keyboard tucked away in the corner flexed his fingers and started to play, and we shuffled to our feet. The words to the hymn were printed in the booklet, but I found that I could remember them from childhood. The communal singing was of extremely poor quality, more like an atonal mumble, and the minister's unpleasant voice was overly loud, perhaps because he was wearing a lapel microphone. He really ought to turn it off for the hymns, I thought. There was no need to amplify his caterwauling. Raymond, to my immense surprise, had a pleasant light tenor, and he was singing properly, unlike most other people. When did people become embarrassed to sing in public? Was it because of the decline in church-going? And yet the television schedule was full of singing contests in which people, however untalented, were far from shy about participating. Perhaps people are only interested in giving solo performances. Surely this was the ultimate in disrespect, to attend a man's funeral and mumble during hymns which, however dreary, had been specifically selected to commemorate his life. I began to sing more loudly. Raymond and I were making more noise than the next four pews put together, and I was glad of it. The words were incredibly sad, and for an atheist like myself, entirely without hope or comfort, but still, it was our duty to sing them to the best of our ability and to sing proudly in honour of Sammy. I sat down when it was finished, happy that Raymond and I had shown him the respect he deserved. Quite a few people turned around to look at us, presumably because they had enjoyed our vocal tribute. The minister spoke about Sammy's life. It was interesting to hear that he'd grown up near a tiny village in the northeast on a sheep farm. He'd joined the merchant navy when he left school, but soon tiring of life at sea, he'd pitched up in Glasgow with £10, a new suit, and no desire whatsoever to return to farming. He'd met Jean in Woolworths, looking for a needle and thread. The minister, looking pleased with himself, said that they'd stitched a happy life together after that. There was a brief religious bit, the usual balderdash, and then, like the assistant in Tesco, he made the coffin conveyor belt move, and Sammy checked out. Bright as a button, smile plastered on as though this were the best part of the whole terrible event, the minister announced that we would sing the final hymn. Raymond and I made a valiant effort, but it's impossible to sing when you're crying. There's a lump like a plum stone lodged in your throat, and the music can't get past it. Raymond blew his nose and passed me a packet of tissues, which I gratefully accepted. The family, the minister told us, would be very pleased if we would join them afterwards at the Hawthorne House Hotel for light refreshments. The congregation filed out, shaking hands and mumbling meaningless platitudes. I did the same. There was a collection basket for the British Heart Foundation, in lieu of flowers, and I saw Raymond drop in a £20 note. I put in £3 coins. If anything, I felt that this was overly generous. Researching new drugs and efficacious treatments for heart disease cost hundreds of millions of pounds. £3 or £300. It was hardly going to swing the balance between finding and not finding a cure, after all. I perched on a low wall behind the crematorium and turned my face to the sun. I felt utterly exhausted. After a moment, Raymond sat beside me, and I heard the click of his lighter. I didn't even have the energy to move away. He blew out a long stream of smoke.
"All right," he said.
I nodded. "You?"
He shrugged. "Not a big fan of funerals, to be honest," he said.
He looked away.
"Reminds me of my dad. It was years ago, but it's still hard, you know."
I nodded. That made sense. Time only blunts the pain of loss. It doesn't erase it. "I really, really, really do not want to go to the Hawthorne House Hotel for light refreshments, Raymond," I said. "I want to stop thinking about death. I just want to go home, put on normal clothes, and watch television." Raymond stubbed his cigarette out and then buried it in the flower bed behind us.
"No one wants to go to these things, Eleanor," he said gently. "You have to, though, for the family."
I must have looked sad.
"You don't need to stay long," he said, his voice soft and patient. "Just show face, have a cup of tea, eat a sausage roll, You know the drill.
Well, I hope they've at least got a high meat content and friable pastry, I said, more in hope than expectation, and shouldering my handbag. The Hawthorne House Hotel was walking distance from the crematorium. The woman at the reception desk smiled, and it was impossible not to notice that she had only one front tooth. The remaining molars were the exact same shade as Coleman's English mustard. I'm not one to make judgments about other people's personal appearance, but really, of all the available staff, was this woman the best choice for the front desk? She directed us to the Bramble Suite and flashed us a gappy, sympathetic smile. We were among the last to arrive, as most people had driven the short journey from the crematorium to the hotel. The crematorium was a busy place, and the parking spaces were needed, I supposed. I'm not sure I'd like to be burned. I think I might like to be fed to zoo animals. It would be both environmentally friendly and a lovely treat for the larger carnivores. Could you request that, I wondered. I made a mental note to write to the WWF in order to find out. I went up to Keith and told him how very sorry I was, and then I sought out Gary to say the same thing. Both of them looked overwhelmed, which was understandable. It takes a long time to learn to live with loss, assuming you ever manage it. After all these years, I'm still something of a work in progress in that regard. The grandchildren sat quietly in the corner, cowed perhaps by the sombre atmosphere. The other person I had to pass on my condolences to was Laura, but I couldn't spot her. She was usually easy to find. Today, as well as the huge sunglasses, she'd been wearing vertiginous heels, a short black dress with a plunging neckline, and her hair was piled on top of her head in an artful birdcage creation that added several inches to her height. There being no sign of her, and no sign of the promised refreshments either, I went in search of the lavatories. I would have put money on their having a dusty bowl of apricot-scented potpourri beside the washbasins, and I was right. On the way back, I spotted a telltale platform heel poking out from behind a swagged curtain. There was a window seat recess, in which Laura was sitting in the lap of a man who, it soon became apparent, was Raymond, although they were embracing so closely that it took a moment before I could see his face and be sure. He was wearing black leather shoes, I noticed, so he did at least possess a pair. I went back into the Bramble Suite without disturbing them. They hadn't seen me, being very much otherwise engaged. This was an all too familiar social scenario for me, standing alone, staring into the middle distance. It was absolutely fine. It was absolutely normal. After the fire at each new school, I tried so hard, but something about me just didn't fit. There was, it seemed, no Eleanor-shaped social hole for me to slot into. I wasn't good at pretending, that was the thing. After what had happened in that burning house, given what went on there, I could see no point in being anything other than truthful with the world. I had, literally, nothing left to lose. But by careful observation from the sidelines, I'd worked out that social success is often built on pretending just a little. Popular people sometimes have to laugh at things they don't find very funny, do things they don't particularly want to, with people whose company they don't particularly enjoy. Not me. I had decided years ago that if the choice was between that or flying solo, then I'd fly solo. It was safer that way. Grief is the price we pay for love, so they say. The price is far too high. The buffet had been laid out. Yes, there were sausage rolls, but also sandwiches. Staff were dispensing indistinguishable tea and coffee from bitter-smelling urns into industrial white crockery. This wouldn't do at all. I was decidedly not in the mood for hot brown liquid. Oh, no. I was in the mood for cool, clear vodka. All hotels had bars, didn't they? I wasn't a great frequenter of hostelries, but I knew that bedrooms and bars were their raison d'être. I spoke to the dentally challenged lady in reception again, who directed me down another long corridor, at the end of which lay the imaginatively named Hawthorne Lounge. I stood on the threshold and looked around. The place was deserted, the fruit machines flashing purely for their own amusement. I walked in, just me, Eleanor, alone. A barman was watching TV and absent-mindedly polishing glasses.
"Home's under the hammer,"
he said, turning towards me. I remember thinking, surprised, that he was possibly attractive, and then chastising myself for the thought. My prejudice was that beautiful, glamorous people would not be at work in the Hawthorne House Hotel on a Friday lunchtime. Granted, the receptionist had confirmed my initial thoughts, but really it was shameful of me to have these preconceptions. Where on earth did they come from? A little voice whispered the answer in my head. Mummy. The barman smiled, revealing a lovely set of teeth and clear blue eyes.
"It's a load of old shite," he said, in a voice that could strip paint from walls after giving them a good sanding down first.
"See? Told you,"
Mummy whispered.
"Is it?" I said. "Unfortunately, I'm not generally at home during the day to see it."
"Watch it here if you like,"
the man said, shrugging. "Could I?"
"Why not?" he said. "It's not like there's much else going on, is there?"
He gestured around the empty bar. I perched on a bar stool, something I've always wanted to try, and ordered a vodka and cola. He made it slowly, added ice and lemon without asking, and pushed it towards me.
"Funeral, was it?"
he said. I wondered how he knew, and then I realized that I was dressed entirely in black, that my smoky eye makeup had run somewhat, and that there was no other reason to be in this particular venue at this time of day. I nodded. No further exchanges were required, and we both settled back to see how Ian and Dorothy would fare with the 1970s terrace that they'd bought at auction for £95,000, intending to renovate the bathroom, install a new kitchen, and knock through from the lounge to the dining room.
"The finishing touch," the presenter said, "was to paint the front door this fetching shade of green."
"Green door," the barman said, without missing a beat, and seconds later, lo and behold, that very song began to play.
We both laughed, and he pushed another vodka towards me without my having to ask. We had moved on to Loose Women, another programme I was unfamiliar with. I was on my fourth vodka by now, and the funeral service was there in my mind, but it didn't hurt. Like noticing you had a stone in your shoe, but while you were sitting down, rather than walking on it. I thought that I probably ought to attempt a sausage roll at some point, or at least put a few in my bag for later. But then I remembered that I had brought my new tiny bag, into which I could fit at most two savoury pastries. I tutted and shook my head.
"What's up?" said the barman.
We hadn't asked each other's names. It didn't seem necessary somehow. I slumped forward on my stool and stared, in clichéd fashion, into my glass.
"Oh, it's nothing," I said breezily. "I suppose I ought to have something to eat now, really."
The barman, who had become less handsome as time had worn on, picked up my glass, filled it back up with vodka and a dash of cola, and returned it to me.
"No rush, eh?" he said. "Why not stay here and keep me company for a while longer?"
I looked around. The bar was still deserted.
"You might need a little lie down after this one, eh?"
he said, tapping my glass and leaning very close to me. I could see the enlarged pores on the sides of his nose, some of them filled with microscopic black dots.
"Perhaps," I said. "Sometimes I do need a lie down after vodka and cola."
He smiled wolfishly.
"Puts you in the mood, eh?"
I tried to lift my eyebrows into a question, but strangely could only make one of them rise. I'd had too much to drink because I'd had too much pain, and there was nowhere else it could go but down, drowned in the vodka. Simple, really.
"What do you mean?"
I said, hearing that I was pronouncing the consonants somewhat indistinctly.
Funerals, he said, moving closer to me so that his face was almost pressed against mine. He smelled of onions. It's nothing to feel bad about, he said. All that death.